Welcome to Designing Futures, exploring AI, data, architecture, and beyond. In this podcast, we dive deep into the insights, groundbreaking ideas, and innovative approaches shared by our guests.
Together, we explore the immense potential of AI for architecture and design, unraveling its remarkable possibilities and acknowledging the challenges it presents.
Florian, it's great to have you with us on the podcast today. Florian Schneider, you are a filmmaker, writer, and curator. You have been engaged in a wide range of projects to rethink impact and value of documentary practices across different disciplines. Since 2013, you have been professor for art theory and documentary practices at NTNU, the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. And from 2019 to 2023, you have been chair of the COST Action, which is a European Forum for Advanced Practices. And we are very happy to announce also that since March 1st, as of today, you coordinate the Research and Innovation Action Pacesetters, which is funded by Horizon Europe, and it's a research program of the European Commission. And the reason why we wanted to have you as a guest follows our reading of your recent article, Artificial Intelligence and Design. Your text explores the impact of artificial intelligence on creativity and the concept of ownership, and particularly in architecture and the broader cultural and creative industries. It traces the historical evolution of intellectual property laws, emphasizing how AI is actually disrupting traditional creative processes. So maybe to start, could you explain how the notion of intellectual property evolved from the 19th century to the arrival of AI?
Yeah, this is, of course, a very complex history. And it's, practically impossible to break this down in one answer. But I think there is something that is, that I, at least I find it particularly remarkable. And here exactly this time span from the early 19th century till today, or the discussions around IP that we experience today, what I find remarkable is that it seems like there is a circle that is closing. So intellectual property is a very recent phenomenon. I mean, we really need to remind ourselves time and again. This is not a natural fact. It's not a given. It doesn't fall from heaven. It is a kind of social construction. And it is very interesting to look at the emergence of copyright in the 19th century and it was. It's also important to bear in mind that this was not a kind of global phenomenon as today. It was not implemented in every country, but only a very few countries who kind of pioneered this new domain of law or property law. So in the course of the 19th century, at least in a Central European perspective, intellectual property can be considered to have been a privilege of the fine arts. And it's also very interesting that it was categorically refused to the new creative classes that emerged in the course of the 19th century and in the advent of new technologies. And this is most important, photography. So in France, for example, photography was, until the end of the 19th century, not considered a creative act. Instead, the photographer was understood or conceived not to be creative at all. The photographer was just, by law or by the through the judgments of the law, the judges and the courts, the photographer was understood as a prolongation of the machine, of the photographic apparatus. And if we look to the United States at the same time, in the second half of the 19th century, after the Civil War, the juridical discourse on intellectual property faced a completely different challenge. And the judges and the courts there in the US, they were primarily concerned with the question how to get a hold of something that is entirely ephemeral, yeah, that evaporates, that disappears, like the performance of a piece of music, which evades any form of what in the classical conventional sense could be considered possession. Because this concept, this traditional concept of possession or property, is always connected to the concept of conquering and owning land, particularly in the United States. No? So here, and this is very, very interesting, the lawmakers tried a totally different strategy. And they used the analogy of the fugitive slaves to grasp the idea that something that is actually not under your control anymore still can be owned and possessed. And this was a massive juridical operation. And the Fugitive Slave Act, I think from 1852, was the basis of all intellectual property legislation in the United States. So there's very interesting research, academic research over the last years that really traces this emergence of copyright in the early 19th century. However, I think until the end of World War II, in most of the countries, there were no specific laws protecting any patents or intellectual property. And one could even go so far and say that stealing IPR was the driving force of the development of industrial capitalism within the borders of nation states. It massively allowed the creation of these kind of nation state monopolies, especially when it comes to, let's say, household appliances, but also photography. Yeah. So basically the business model was copied over from one country to the other, and this was possible because of the absence of IPR and copyright laws. So it was considered a driver of innovation that appears by translating the technological developments from one national context into another. Yeah. So there are many, many examples from Edison and the emergence of film studios in the US and how they moved from New York to Hollywood, but also the whole history of the Philips company, which acquired these patents without paying any fee, because there was until 1946 or the end of the 1940s, there was no copyright law in the Netherlands. Yeah. So on this basis, you can build a national monopoly. And this situation changed, or maybe one should rather say it turned into its total opposite with the mechanical reproduction of works of art or creative works, and then also the rise of these multinational corporations that operated as state monopolies within the borders of a nation state. And even during the Cold War, this kind of bipolar world order allowed only for partial implementation of intellectual property rights across borders. Yeah? This was very, very limited. And there were many workarounds. I mean, most famously, the production of generic medicine in ex-Yugoslavia. And we saw this phenomenon until the mid or end 90s, for example, in the software pirate markets in all the major cities of the former East. Yeah. So I find it very interesting and also very telling how the rapid rise of IPR, which we have experienced over the past three decades, so basically since the 90s, and of course the kind of so-called globalization, now seems to face a certain decline. And ironically, it is the same question of what I suggest to call co-agency between humans and machines. Yeah, like, is the photographer just a prolongation of the machine and not creative at all, as it was stated in the context of landscape photography in the early 19th century in France? But also when it comes to artificial intelligence and machine learning, which also threatens now not a specific discipline and how the kind of assemblages between human and machine creativity are sorted out or negotiated. I think what characterizes our current situation, in which this is why the discussion is so heated, yeah, AI and machine learning threatens the very understanding, not just of the ownership of a creative product in a kind of traditional sense of intellectual property rights, but how to preserve a notion of creativity as such. And in a sense that is not entirely reproducible by machines who have learned to be creative by expropriating all products of human creativity so far, yeah? Because this is the promise of AI and machine learning. Yeah? So this, I think, is interesting because it repeats the problem that intellectual property encountered in the early 19th century. How can you own something that is already owned? Because this is at stake when the judges ruled about landscape photography. Yeah, so the photographer takes a picture, or the machine, yeah, takes a picture of a landscape, and the landscape consists of lots of plots of lands and buildings that are already owned by owners. Yeah, so how can you claim ownership of something that is already owned? Back then, this was limited to landscape photography, and the discourse changed in the moment when the photography became so advanced that it could also take portrait pictures of human beings. But the question remains the same. How can you own something that is already owned? And this concept of what Bernard Edelman called over-appropriation in the early 70s, this has become today the ultimate condition of technological innovation. It always returns time and again to this question of over-appropriation or owning something that is already owned.
Thank you very much. It's very, very interesting. In your recent article, you expressed in regards to that architecture has been relatively resistant to intellectual property laws compared to other creative industries. Could you explain us why?
Yeah, I mean, I have to confess, I've never spent a lot of thinking about what is the role of intellectual property in architecture. It didn't really come to my mind as a particularly challenging question. And when writing this article, I realized that actually this was a really big mistake, because architecture plays indeed a very, very interesting role in the context of this debate. And this is on one hand, I mean, it's kind of overshadowed by the indisputable desire of architects to create projects that are unique and unprecedented. I mean, it's the kind of the star architecture that we usually refer to when we talk about architecture. But in fact, plagiarizing, imitating, and copying in the field of architecture still has a moral value that I think cannot be underestimated. And it would be very, very interesting to do further research in this direction. So, I mean, usually when we talk about plagiarism in architecture, the standard example or cliche or stereotype is the replication of landmark buildings, or sometimes also, I think, entire villages or cities throughout China. Yeah. If I'm not completely wrong, I think this has been there was a political decision in China to stop this practice. but still, copying and relocating, yeah, is a constitutive element of the entire history of architecture. And this is, of course, very, very interesting in every period. But studying and reproducing the designs of previous generations is still a constitutive part of architectural education. Yeah? This is maybe different to, for example, educational models or approaches in contemporary art or in fine art, yeah, where I mean, there was a certain break in the 1960s, 1970s, and under this banner of contemporaneity, I mean, you were even encouraged to forget about history, no? I mean, and ignore whether what you are planning or trying to do has already been done by somebody else. So this was also, it also can have a very liberating effect, no? When you forget about history. But this is not the case in architecture, obviously. And this also has to do with, I mean, the complexity of the architectural challenge and the architectural education. And you need access to archives and plans and sketches. Yeah. Therefore, copying is the condition to acquire or to gain this access or this specific knowledge, which also, by the way, is absolutely necessary in order to speak about is necessary for the emergence of style or an architectural style. No, I mean. Which is very, very important in the field of architecture. So, and this is style appears through appropriating and remixing the elements of designs that already exist, and this is then the basis for creations that are considered new. Yeah. So, this is a totally different discourse in architecture, where this is I would. Say, from my impression, perfectly legitimate, yeah, as opposed to, let's say, the music industry, hip-hop sampling, etc. Yeah. So there is a tremendous contrast between the visual and the written arts on one hand, yeah, and architecture, which, in my understanding, but again, this needs to be further investigated and researched. Yeah? Appears as relatively resistant to the idea of enforcing intellectual property laws as it happened with any other creative discipline, latest from the beginning of the 20th century, when creative practices turned into whole industries. Photography or film. So I think that this gradual expansion of IP regimes from being rather limited to products of the entertainment industry, because they have a certain sales potential, yeah, to virtually any output of cultural and creative industries, that this has become a very important pillar of the kind of economy that we are facing today in late capitalism. Yeah.
We will come back to this question of late capitalism and the economy, but I just wanted to touch on something that you mentioned now, and if we can see a parallel between. I mean, this idea of reusing something from the past and reinterpreting it, that, as you quite elegantly explained, has at least been the basis of architecture for a very long time. I think the way that intellectual property applies to architectural creation today is very much on the actual, the building itself, which in some countries, it's very country dependent, but in some countries, you're not allowed to amend the actual work of art as the architecture building without the acknowledgement or the authorization of its original author as an object, but very correctly, as you explain, the whole theoretical approach to architecture has been very much about this reinterpreting of past knowledge and styles in some cases, and the emergence of new styles are really based on that. Do you see, and if we take that in the context of the parallel you made between the how to interpret the ownership of something that's already owned, in what we see today with the emergence of a lot of AI tools that are used in creative industries and generative image making, the fact that these tools have learned their their trade or the language on which they're based is having taken existing material to reinterpret it. So where does this question of ownership start? Is it the person who created the original material that is being used to learn the language? Or is it the creation that the machine is generating? Or the person who's prompting the machine to generate these?
I mean, two things. On one hand, I think, and this I really just realized over the last months. No, I mean, I did. I spent 10 or 12 years being obsessed with these questions. What does it mean to own an image? Yeah? How can you navigate these questions of property and ownership in the age of digitization and globalization. Yeah, but now with a little bit of a distance, and this was for me, the, as I said, the really stunning experience of writing this article and revisiting work that I did quite some time ago. Yeah, there is quite a lot that we can learn from architecture. Yeah, so I mean, not in terms of making moral judgments. Yeah, like this is good and this is bad. Yeah, or evil. Yeah, I think we have to demoralize the entire discussion about intellectual property, and we have to. Or we can learn here, I think, a great deal from the history of architecture and how architecture navigated these challenges and these questions in the last, probably, let's say, 100 years or so. what you mentioned is actually a really good it's a really good starting point for such a it could be a comparative analysis. Yeah, I mean, what is the relationship between monument protection? Yeah, or the entire discourse about monument protection. I mean, I am currently living in a country that is obsessed with monument protection because there are not so many monuments. Because until very recent, everything was built from wood. Yeah, so basically, every building that is older than 50 years is automatically under monument protection. So, which produces quite some obstacles for architects. Yeah. So how can you relate this entire, or how does this discourse of monument protection, yeah, preserving the past as a cultural heritage, yeah, how does this relate to the opposite question? Yeah, what does it mean to create something new? And how is the new always a kind of reusing or repurposing, yeah, or retranslation of something that under other circumstances would be easily discarded as old? Yeah,
which is a very European way interpreting the object, because of course in Japanese culture, for example, the building is actually rebuilt identically over time, because it's not the object itself that is sacrilege, or that is the important element. It's the image of it, or the concept of it, or I don't know, yeah. What the right word to describe impression. It in terms of intellectual property. But
it's the impression. I mean, I think it's. I live at the moment in a wooden house, which is an old farm that was dismantled in the mid of the 19th century. Probably the building is much older, probably from the 18th or 17th century. It was a farmhouse in the north of Norway, and after the city burnt down in 1842 or so, the house was deconstructed in the north and rebuilt in the center of the town, because people needed shelter and houses, and they just took what was available. Yeah, so I live in a farmhouse in the center of a small town. Since it's wood, it constantly has to be rebuilt and renew itself. Yeah, so protecting it in a kind of conventional sense would be disastrous. And you have the same discussion at the emergence of big film archives and film museums. Yeah? In the early 1960s, I think when the first film museums were founded in Paris and in Vienna, there was a big discussion among the curators and the museum directors. So shall we focus on preserving the film? Because it's a very fragile, a film copy, no? It's a very fragile thing, and it deteriorates the more often you show it, no? So,
yes, yeah.
And so there was one group of people who insisted on let's not show the films, because this is the only chance how we can preserve the material integrity of the copy. And then there was the opposite approach, which I think was the more exciting and more productive one. And this is, constituted our understanding of a film museum today. And they said, no, the opposite is true. We have to show the film as much and as often as possible, because this is the only way how we can actually preserve it. From this, from this consideration about what does it mean to protect or to own a copy for the sake of protection, I think most of what we consider today as a kind of European film culture or the cinema des auteurs, emerged from this discussion. Film is there to be shown, no matter what happens to the material integrity of the copy. But maybe these are now.
This goes, there's preservation and copyrights. But I can say maybe one thing, because I've worked with the notion of archives for very long, and there are two things that I think are quite interesting. First, when you look into the documentary world, whenever you use archival footage, you understand that the whole notion of AP is very related as well by the end to commercial use. So you're allowed to use things under the use of fair use. Whenever you are obliged to show an archival from the news that costs a lot of money, if it's under the fair use that you are talking about something and showing it, then you're allowed to show it for free. But if you actually interpret something, if you're using archival footage because as a filmmaker you want to actually say another story about it, then it can't get under the fair use usage, and then you're obliged to pay. So it's quite interesting to look at that in the creative processes of the reappropriation in the field of cinema. Whenever it's about like saying something new, you pay. If it's about like just like saying a factual thing about a historical thing that you need to show it, then you're allowed to kind of, you have lots of lawyers on it, but you can claim at least that you had a right to do it. And I will say it just like one last thing, and then we can move again to your text, but I don't know if you know about Yerushalmi, who wrote a very interesting book about the notion of memory, but he went to the archives of Freud himself, and he found that actually the father of Sigmund Freud, offered him the Bible. And when he offered the Bible to his son, it was a Bible that came from his great-great-parents, he actually put a new cover on it. And that's how he presented to his son, basically, by telling that each generation has the obligation, actually, of reinterpreting the archives by putting a new layer on it, that the reappropriation is actually... So it's very interesting between, in the creative process, between the notion of the law, IP, copyrights, whenever there's a bit of a commercial aspect as well to it, to kind of maybe the more philosophical approach of where it meets a bit more architecture, that each generation actually needs to constantly revisit the past and reappropriate and create out of it something new. So I thought it was, in light of what you said, quite an interesting point.
No, absolutely. And every generation, its own constitution, no? This is, and instead of becoming... more and more general in this discussion, which is the usual tendency or the the certain threat or danger. I think we have to become more and more specific. We have to look at the different ways how the creative disciplines developed very, very different strategies dealing with this. And I think this is where. The interesting value propositions for the future will emerge from again.
If we go back to your text, you're talking about something that is, I think, very, very interesting as well. You explained that, so as you explained at the beginning, that the intellectual property regime have expanded during the 20th century, and I think you explained that very well. You say that it's becoming a crucial aspect of the emerging data economy. Could you maybe explain to us a little bit what is the data economy and why intellectual property regime have actually expanded faster under this regime?
Yeah, this is this is the crucial question. No, I mean, if we could answer this in a very simple and understandable way, then I think we would have gained a lot of made a lot of progress. So let me try. I mean, with data economy, I mean a global ecosystem in which data is on one hand gathered, no, or mined, as it is called sometimes. So in which data is gathered, organized, and then also exchanged or circulated. Yeah? And for me, the interesting thing, and this is something I discovered relatively early in my research, that this economy is driven by extraction of value that takes place on a meta level. It does not take place on the or value is not created with the binary data of the movie that you upload, or the picture, or the piece of music. Yeah? The profit is generated by an exploitation of data that tracks, evaluates, and also anticipates future consumer behavior. So this is a kind of data that operates on a meta level of data. It's data about data. And the added value of the kind of data-driven intelligences, yeah, that exploit and evaluate and anticipate behavior, this does no longer provide insights about what has happened in the past. This would be the kind of classical conventional understanding of statistics. Yeah, I mean, we count what has happened, yeah, and then we have an idea of what has happened in the past. So we have now a shift that in this data economy, what matters and what creates value is the fact that it is supposed to tell us what will happen in the future, because it claims to know what we want and what we will do. Yeah. So, and this, I think, has tremendous consequences for our understanding of creativity and what it means to create something new.
As in, you mean that our creativity might be driven by what the data predicts should happen?
Yeah, I think it's a shift, no? I mean, the current discussion that... I mean, it's all over the place about AI and machine learning. It's about, will it annihilate human creativity as such? No? I don't think so. I think probably it will have quite a liberating and empowering effect in the sense that it will promote new notions of what we call artistic intelligence. That's much, much more interesting than the kind of repetitive tasks that are dominating the creative industries at the moment. But I think this is... this is important and interesting on one hand, but on the other hand, when we look at the kind of economical basis of this data economy or gig economy, sometimes called, yeah, this is not about creativity. This is about consumer behavior, and it's about anticipating consumer behavior in the future rather than accounting for certain patterns of behavior in the past. Of course, it needs to learn, or it needs to be trained by behavior of the past. Yeah, but the focus is shifting, and this is a tremendous shift. Yeah? The focus of the analysis of statistical data, or the generation of metadata, or the extraction and exploitation of this user data, connection data, and who has bought this and who liked this would also like that, and so on and so forth. The value that is extracted from this analysis of user or consumer behavior, the value refers to an anticipation of what will happen in the future. And it will tell us, or it is supposed to tell us, and we can't, I mean, can't just say, okay, I ignore this, I don't believe it, I don't do it. I mean, it has already colonized every aspect of everyday behavior. Yeah. So it's based on models that are reinterpreting what happened in the past in order to predict on this basis what we are going to do in the future. And so other people call this data economy surveillance capitalism, or there's a multitude of different proposals how to name this. Yeah, but I think this shift is the important aspect, and we're in the middle of this shift, and we are experiencing it at the moment, and we are trying to get a hold of it. And I think that the heated discussion about AI is just a symptom of this shift.
So talking about this notion of individual authorship that was very dear to us up to now, one of the key concepts that you bring forward is the concept of co-agency between humans and machines and other actors, with the emergence of the AI and modes of production. How does this redefine the notions of individual authorship and influence the ethical landscape of the creative process?
These are basically... or co-agency is one of the proposals that we make in order to operate as a counter concept to the algorithmic determination of our lives. So this co-agency, and this here, I think, is connected in a very interesting way to the discussion about intellectual property we had so far. This co-agency depends on a concept of co-ownership, not in terms of owning an object or a product. Yeah, I think what is at stake is the co-ownership of a transformation process. I think we see this at the moment all over Europe in the protests of farmers and people from rural areas against the current transformation processes in the context of the climate transition. Yeah, I mean, it obviously points to a lack of ownership. They don't feel part of this process, let alone having anything to say in the course of this process, in terms of benefits and losses. Yeah. So I think this notion of co-agency refers to new capacities to act together and take it together. They appear as more as just the sum of their parts. Yeah. So I'm very convinced that new forms of working and acting together, yeah, and this really includes now humans and machines, or humans and more than humans. Yeah. So these new forms of working and acting together will also generate a different understanding of ownership, in a sense of a collective ownership. And I would say this, I would lay this parallel to the process how the assembly line in industrial capitalism generated the idea of housing cooperatives across Europe, yeah, often union run, yeah. But I mean, the idea that workers co-own the buildings in which they live relatively close to the factory, often also very much supported by the owners of the factories. No? So in a similar way as the assembly line produced this idea of owning houses together, which was, I think, completely revolutionary and absolutely unimaginable in the beginning of the 20th century. Yeah? We are experiencing today a similar situation with artificial intelligence, machine learning, where we also have to say goodbye to these obsessions of individual authorship and originality that in the end stems from the project, the big project of romanticism. So the common understanding of what it means for an individual to create something new, this has been dominated by strategies of extractivism, exploitation, and that all in the end are connected to the colonial conquest. No, it's the idea of pioneering, and we need to decolonize our very idea of innovation by moving away from a model of creativity and entrepreneurship that is based on individual and also always very, very short-term incentives, yeah, to another model of creativity and entrepreneurship that is driven by co-agency, co-ownership of the transformation processes, and then the new capacities to act together in sustainable ways that emerge from it. And I think here we, in our research project that we just started, yeah, today, we suggested to investigate these processes or these shifts through the lens of three concepts. This is shared creativity. Yeah, so creativity is no longer the privilege of a creative class. It no longer happens on a purely, exclusively individual basis. It's a collective process. Yeah, that is built on this. The second concept, an understanding of collective intelligences. Also maybe as a kind of counter model to artificial intelligences, yeah, collective intelligence can also involve totally analog forms of creating knowledge. Yeah, but the main thing, and here we come back to the original question, the main challenge is to organize these forms of working and acting together in decentralized or distributed architectures. This is what we can learn from the kind of peer-to-peer networks as a form of organization, but also from digital ledger technology or blockchain technologies. Yeah, I mean, how to authorize the responsibility, or how to authorize and also reward the responsibility for a process based on a certain level of responsiveness that appears in a decentralized fashion and is not authorized through a central authority. Yeah. I think these are very, very exciting prospects that would allow us theoretically to come up with equally exciting concepts like the cooperatives of the early 20th century.
I was going to refer to that because obviously these have been examples where there have been a kind of a common effort to produce something. But I think with the and sorry to come back to that, these were common initiatives to do something where the machine might have been used, but as a tool, not as a generative element. I think what this your proposal brings as a question, and we wanted to cover as well, is then the question of accountability, because if it's a co-authorship that includes the artificial intelligence as part of this creative process, who's accountable? Is the human aspect of it responsible for the accountability? Obviously, not the developer of the AI tools and the language that is being used. I mean, the notion of accountability, then it's almost as if the intellectual property question shifts to the question of accountability.
Yes. No, absolutely. Sure. I mean, from the very simple example, I mean, who's responsible for a car crash? If the car is running in self-driving mode. This is a relatively banal instance, yeah, compared to the challenges that we have that we will have to face in the future. And I think here these two concepts of co-agency and co-ownership and the resulting forms of responsibility that are no longer based on individual ownership and centralized authorization of this individual ownership. Yeah. So decentralized, distributed architectures that are built on models of shared creativity and collective intelligences. This would be the kind of cornerstones of what we want to investigate in the next years. Yeah. How can we find practical solutions and how can we implement and test this in creative contexts that are not in the centers of that are usually associated with the creative classes, not in Barcelona, Berlin, Amsterdam, and London, but off the beaten track. Yeah? So in rural and remote areas, we think that this is where we can experiment and develop these models in a under kind of not really lab conditions, but I mean in contexts that are less, maybe not less complex, but that are still kind of overseeable, or where the impact is more tangible, where the impact is can be experienced and immediately traced and tracked, and also where you can change things in a much, much faster and easier way. Yeah. So this is the big challenge we want to address in a series of small-scale experiments across Europe.
Maybe just as a last question, but I don't know if it's, I don't know how much you're familiar with the new EU AI Act, but I was wondering if you have a bit of information about that, if you think that this is something as well that is going to revisit a little bit the how to reshape the intellectual property or the notion of accountability regarding all the topics and subjects that we dwelled upon here during the. I don't know if there's anything that you can add on that or not, but
I'm not an expert. On this, but I have several friends and long-term collaborators who were very much engaged in this process and still are. I think it's just the beginning. It's not really my field of expertise, but what I think is important in this context, and this is also something that the people who really know about the AI Act are pointing to. It is, first of all, a very interesting question of architecture. I think this happens in or this is true in two in two directions or in the two senses. On one hand, I mean, we can understand architecture as an artificial intelligence. And then at the same time, we can also understand artificial intelligence as an architecture. So in a certain sense, I mean, this is what I was trying to argue for in this article. Every building can be understood as an artificial intelligence, no matter whether we talk about the smart city of the past, the Moorish medieval towns of Andalusia, or the building information models today, which are storing all sorts of data that appear in the construction process from the very beginning till the end or beyond its end in a central database. So every building is created through a kind of co-agency between human and non-human, and these are often natural actors. Yeah? And it learns, every building learns over time, and it learns by its use. So this is what I would say constitutes the value of a building. Yeah, and my hypothesis would be the more these three principles that I mentioned earlier, shared creativity, collective intelligences, and distributed architectures, the more that these principles are reflected in the creative process from the very beginning to the end, the higher the value of a built environment. I think one could argue this relatively consistently. But on the other hand, artificial intelligence and machine learning operate on the basis of data architectures that are very complex constructions that are based on a model that reflects a certain understanding of reality and reduces the complexity of this reality into calculations and equations that then extrapolate future scenarios, as we discussed earlier, in their models of machine intelligence and computational systems. So without a critical understanding of the concept of a model, and again, we can learn a lot from architecture and architectural education and how the masters were copied and so on and so forth. Yeah. So without a critical understanding of these models of machine intelligence and computational systems, we will never ever be able to get a hold of these rapid developments that characterize AI and machine learning. So I think both approaches imply very, very serious challenges in terms of economic, ethic, and also aesthetic sustainability. And we, as I said, we want to try to address these questions from different perspectives and then investigate the innovation potentials that could emerge from these assumptions. Yeah? So I think this is very, very necessary as a precondition before we then look at the concrete legislation. Because on one hand, the AI Act seems like a progressive and also, I mean, I would say for the first time, a proactive approach, yeah, towards a new emerging technology or a new technology. So far, the lawmakers and the policymakers were very, very passive when it comes to this, with a delay of 50 to 80 years responded to technologies, yeah, as we can see in the whole discussion about intellectual property. So now it's a proactive approach, and it showcases the capacities of the EU to negotiate a kind of deal or a certain degree of hope that the business models that are based on the exploitation of IPR can survive even this current wave of automatization and digitalization to, I mean, totally unprecedented extent. Yeah, but this will not change the fact that in the film industry, for example, 60 to 70% of the jobs will be lost. Yeah. On the other hand, I think it is also dangerous to simulate situations that promise as if we could just continue with business as usual without radically questioning the way how we understand both human and non-human or machine creativity. So I think I would like to focus on this part rather than the legal aspects.
That's Great. I think that begs that we will have a chat again in a few months' time when you'll have more feedback from the experiments that you're conducting, which will be very interesting to discuss how, what conclusions you make from these and how this adds to the discussion. I will also say that we will put a link to the article that we've mentioned a few times in our talk on the podcast page so that people can also read it. But I think it was a passionate discussion about that opens up a lot of questions, of course, in this new emerging economy and creative landscape that we're embarking on. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your questions and assumptions with us and our listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you. It was really, really fascinating. Really interesting. Thank you very much, Florian.
No, thank you. I really appreciate and enjoyed the opportunity. And I think, I mean, it was really, really, I mean, it's fascinating to see how these considerations and this research that has started in a completely different context of a modern art museum in 2006, how this is gaining traction now and becomes relevant in a completely unforeseeable a new and different context. Yeah. So thanks a lot for this opportunity. And I really, really think it will be awesome to continue this discussion with the specific focus on architecture.
Definitely. We'd love to do that as well. I think if you see a context in which we can talk about this together, or even think about some questions and input, we'd love to contribute. And we're very curious and interested to see what your studies will also add and result in, and whether it's a human nature can be is it a question of human nature or of interpretation and of regulation that is will take the forefront.
Thank you.
We greatly appreciate you tuning into our podcast. If you have any suggestions for future guests or topics you'd like us to explore, we would love to hear from you. You can find our contact information in the show notes or on our website.
Thank you again for being part of our podcast community. Stay tuned for more engaging discussions, captivating stories, and valuable insights.